during the sermon series called Tension, I have been walking through chapter by chapter through the book of Daniel. We've called this series Tension because the book of Daniel so well illustrates the tension between someone who is trying to live for God in this world, but also at the same time living in this world. There's some rough edges that we run into there. It says it many times in the New Testament. The New Testament, this is an extremely recurring theme that comes up time and time again. And here's one verse that says it. It says, "All who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted." That's not just one little verse that we can be like, oh, let's look at the context. That's a theme throughout the whole New Testament, is that people who want to live a godly life are going to be persecuted. That's a recurring thing. And we see that not just in the New Testament as a theme, but we see that also get played out in the world today, but also in the Old Testament. People didn't necessarily live a godly life for Christ because they didn't have Jesus yet, but lived a godly life for God before Christ entered the scene. And a book all about that is the book of Daniel. And one overarching lesson throughout the entire book of Daniel addresses that theme pretty well, because the theme of the book of Daniel is, despite any present appearances, God is in control. That's the theme of the whole book, is that despite whatever's going on right now, God is always in control. It's true in Daniel's life, as we'll see, and it's true especially in the story that we so often call Daniel in the Lion's Den. The story I'm sure many people have at least heard of before. I don't think that's a good name for it, obviously. Not obviously. I don't know. Obviously is the next word in my notes. Obviously, the name is stuck, and obviously it's the name for the climax of the story, but the lion's den is a really small part of this whole chapter that I think is about something entirely different than just lions. It's about law. It's about law more than anything else, I think, this chapter. If you read through the chapter, and we are going to read every verse in the chapter, you'll see these words that keep coming up time and time again. The words law, edict, ordinance, and similar words like that, decree. Those words are probably more numerous than any other type of noun that occurs in this chapter. It's a very political chapter in that sense. And so the theme of the book, placed into the context of this exact chapter, is that despite any present tension because of worldly laws, God's law will always win. Despite whatever laws are in the current situation, God's law will always be more and work out better in the end. Now, we're going to start reading the story, Daniel chapter 6. You can follow along on the screens, or you can turn there in your own Bibles or your digital devices. If you need a Bible ever, just let me know and I'll get you one instantly. But once I turn there, I will start reading out of Daniel chapter 6. Verse 1, "It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them 3 high officials, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps should give account, so that the king might suffer no loss. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other high officials and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Then the high officials and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom, but they could find no ground or complaint or any fault because he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, 'We shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God.'" If you remember from last week, if you were here, if you know the flow of the story of the book of Daniel, Darius is the new king of Babylon. Belshazzar was the king before Darius, and before him were lots of kings, but the first one before him in the Bible was Nebuchadnezzar. But now we have Darius. He's the new king of Babylon. He's not king of the empire, actually. There's the Medo-Persian Empire, which is to the north of Babylon. We talked about the history lesson of them invading last week. But he's just king over Babylon only, and the emperor is over him. It's similar to, if you're in the New Testament, you hear of King Herod. We know that he wasn't Caesar. There was a Caesar emperor over him. He was just the king of his little section. So kings can be smaller than the whole kit and caboodle. And Darius is one of those guys. He's the new king of Babylon. But this Darius decides to divide his kingdom into 120 satrapies, over which there are 3 rulers over them. And you'll notice throughout this chapter that Darius has a very high view of Daniel. And the scripture doesn't really tell us why. We as the readers look at it and we know why. Daniel's a pretty cool guy. We've had five chapters to learn about how awesome Daniel is. But Darius, he's the new ruler. He's fresh on the scene, but it seems he's pretty shrewd and pretty wise, and he's able to pick out Daniel as a smart guy, a guy who knows what he's doing, has a spirit of excellence in him. And it probably also helped that Daniel didn't really have any connections to Babylon and like the previous dynasty because he was an exile there. So that probably worked out in his favor. But those verses I've already read also introduce the politics of this day. There's 120 satrapies. To contemporize a little bit, we could call it 120 county mayors, and over them there are three state governors, if that makes it easier for your head. It's similar concept at play. We learn there's also sort of an election of sorts going on. There's going to be a president soon. A president will be under the king, though. But it's not actually an election. It is really just the king is going to decide, hey, I want this guy to be ruler. But it's still close enough to an election that you see that the other people who aren't going to get that position are trying to take down their opponent. They're trying to find where they can poke holes in this guy, Daniel, because they don't want him. They want to defame his character. They don't want this other guy over them. But that leads me to one thing that sticks out in this chapter. How many politicians can we say are like Daniel? Like, how many politicians have an impeccable character that no one can find any fault in him? I mean, that's pretty rare. Because I don't know about you, but I've kind of, you know, I understand the reasoning that says you should break down a word to see what it means. Politics. Poly is many. Tix is small blood-sucking creatures. And so, I mean, but Daniel's in politics, and he's like above the rest of the crowd. He's got a clean record. He didn't even have to make any, you know, computer components disappear in order to keep his record clean. He's doing fine. And so they go where they can hit him, though, instead, and that is his religion. They go after his faith. And you know what that proves, though? That doesn't just prove he's got a clean record and he's a good, impeccable, upstanding guy, but it also proves that he was not silent about his faith. That people, when they looked at Daniel, they knew that he practiced his faith. When they talked to him, they knew. If you heard about Daniel, you heard about how he practiced his faith, because 120 satrapies were able to look at him and say, that's where we can bring him down. That means it wasn't a private, you know, I'm just going to keep my head down and silent about my religion, I'm just going to make sure I do my job and check out at the end of the day. It wasn't that for Daniel. He was not like that. Everyone knew. Leads me to this question, that if anybody went after you, is that the method they'd go after? Your faith and how you practice it. Is that where they'd target you if they went after you? I think all too many of us could be brought down a lot easier. But Daniel is a man of integrity, and you seem to only really find men of integrity like that when faith is at play. And Daniel is one of these guys. So these men of power go after this man of integrity, and we can read on. Then these high officials and satraps came by agreement to the king and said to him, O King Darius, live forever. All the high officials of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors, are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document and injunction. We'll stop there for a minute. I mean, first off, we know these other noblemen are liars, because when do you ever get 120 politicians to agree on anything? And so they don't. But also, I'm pretty sure Daniel would have disagreed too. So obviously when they say, everybody's in agreement, king, that's kind of pretty obviously wrong. We know that. That so much of Daniel reminds me of today's society. This is another one of those things where it's, you know, everybody's in agreement, just go along with it. Just everybody agrees that this is the way it really ought to be, so we need to pass a law to enforce it to happen. That's what comes up. And I mean, obviously, if I'm someone who disagrees, then not everyone agrees about this. So why are you telling me everyone agrees and I should shut up? Now that's a train of thought that might pop in our heads sometimes, but let's stay on task. One question I have about this law in particular is, why would Darius think that that's a good law to have on the books, that for 30 days everybody... And that's one thing that sticks out to me, is why in the world Darius passed that law? I mean, even if he's got an ego problem, like, it's still a pretty... You can only pray through him for 30 days, anybody in his kingdom. It wasn't necessarily that he's supposed to be a god. That's not what the law is saying. It's more like saying he has to be the high priest of everything. The law would have been outlawing the practice of private religion, is what it would have been. It's that you can't do anything privately. You need to only obey the state religion for the next 30 days. If you're going to pray, make sure the king knows about it, and he'll present your request to the gods. Would have been that sort of view that was going on there. It's still splitting hairs, playing some semantics, though, because he's extremely arrogant by the passing of this law. But he's king, and he's king. So we'll get on with the story and read the next few verses. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house, where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. Then they came near and said before the king, concerning the injunction, O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes petition to any god or man within 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing stands fast according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be revoked. Then they answered and said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you have signed, but makes his petition 3 times a day. So as soon as Daniel hears this law about how you're not supposed to pray privately and it's all supposed to be through them, what does Daniel go and do? He goes and prays. But the important caveat here is, does the Bible make it sound more like he prayed out of spite against the law, or is it more like he prayed because that's what he always does? The way I read it is that that's what he always does. It's not, oh, that stupid law, I'm going to go pray and show them. That's not what happens here. He went home to pray, and he prays not as an act of defiance, but just because that's who he was. He prays at regular times of thrice daily prayer. How many of us have problems with just one regular time of daily prayer? And he's got 3 daily prayer times. He doesn't just pray once and be like, ha, they'll show me I'm not allowed to pray to before my God. I just did it. He prays 3 times, and it says, as he had done before. It says, he prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. And that's something that makes me think of some portions of our society, but sometimes the ones that we're more inclined to agree with instead of the ones that's like, oh, look at these bad people. It's more like, oh, maybe that's somewhat like us sometimes. We'll suddenly be a whole lot more political when people tell us not to be. Or we'll suddenly wave certain flags when people tell us not to. Or we'll suddenly be more religious when people tell us, oh, you shouldn't be religious. A lot of times we'll just do things out of spite because, oh, you can't tell me I'm not supposed to do that. I'm going to do it more right now. That comes up sometimes. But for one, how many of us have our lives in line when this sort of thing happens? Usually it's just some social stigma, and we're perfectly content to make someone else angry, which is not necessarily a good thing, especially if we don't know who that person is. But with the case of Daniel, though, not only was his life on the line, but his prayers were not some act of defiance. They weren't, you know, I'm going to do this to get back at this stupid law. They were defiant, but they weren't an act of defiance. They were born out of who Daniel was, not simply his reaction to something else. And that's an important thing there. Because we can't really conceptualize it super well, how many of us could say if there's a retroactive law, since we can't think to the future, what if there's a retroactive law for the past 30 days that outlawed the private practice of religion? Not the public, but the private practice of religion. How many of us would be at fault against a law like that? And I don't necessarily mean going to church. That's a public practice. I mean, if someone were watching our walk around the streets during the daytime, if someone watched how often we prayed or took note of every time we spoke to Jesus, about Jesus to others, or kind of how many times we read our Bible, anything like that, what would we be like Daniel, or would we have to be reactive instead of just ourselves? But back to the story, though. One thing that sticks out to me in here is that Daniel, I mean, we call the sermon series tension, but Daniel doesn't really have much tension around him in this. At least the text doesn't make it. Maybe he was a little stressed, but the text does not pull that out whatsoever in this chapter. He's not like, oh no. I mean, because by now he's used to it. He's definitely a senior citizen by now. He's a fairly old gentleman. He's probably used to the pull of living between eternity and living between the present. He's probably used to that by now. For one, also, he's got some pretty good past experiences to back him up. Like, he's going to be like, oh no, what are you going to do? Throw me in a fiery furnace? I mean, he knows God is on his side by this point. But he's used to that tension and that pull. And he's like, you know what? I've been okay my whole life. I'm still going to stick it out with God. I mean, that's maybe thoughts he's having, and it doesn't seem like he worries at all, and he just continues being who he was, which happens to break the law, which initiates another law. He breaks the law of the land, and it starts up the law of the lions, which we will see as we read here. Continuing to read, "Then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel. And he labored till the sun went down to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, 'Know, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or ordinance that the king establishes can be changed.' Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, 'May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you.' And a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, so that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him." As I mentioned earlier, ironically, we find out Darius's night is worse than Daniel's. Daniel got like a cushy pillow of this lion mane, probably. I don't know. But it's a worse night for Darius than Daniel. But before that night comes, Darius is trying to figure out how to get around the law. He's trying to figure out a way to save Daniel. Because one, he thought this guy was impeccable enough to be the leader of his whole nation. So I'd be upset if I lost a person like that to be by my side as well. But he's subject to this law. Now, on the one hand, that's actually a good thing, right? It's a good thing when the king cannot be above the law. That's good when politicians are held to the laws that they pass. That is a sign of a good government when that happens. But on the other hand, it's a stupid law. And so he's stuck in that. On one hand, it's good that it's hard to get around the law. That's why laws are passed, so they won't be ignored. On the other hand, though, he realizes that this law is a contradiction with common sense and with the law of the Lord. He's starting to realize that, probably in his discussions with Daniel that day. And so Daniel is sort of executed. I say sort of executed not because it didn't work, but because it's not technically an execution. The proper terminology is that it is a trial by ordeal. Now, sometimes in the past, there's still some weird places that probably practice it today, but the way you'd put someone on trial is not like sitting them up before a judge and jury and all those things, but you would put them through some crazy ordeal that it's nearly impossible for them to pass, and so then you'd know, oh, well, you're guilty. It's kind of like when you'd see witches, accused witches being thrown into water, and hey, if you float, you're a witch because you can't float when you're bound. But if you sink, oh, oops, it's kind of like that. So there's no good outcome for whoever goes through a trial by ordeal. The convicted felon is given an impossible task to decide whether or not the gods deem them guilty or not. And the den is sealed, and Darius calls out hope to Daniel, and then we keep reading here. "Then at break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, 'O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?' Then Daniel said to the king, 'O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him and also before you, O king. I have done no harm.' Then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. And the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions, they, their children, and their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces." Now that last verse, we didn't do Daniel and the Lion's Den during VBS this last week, but I imagine that last verse is not usually included in Vacation Bible School stories. Usually not. It's not the highlight of the story. It actually, probably to some of the original audience, that was a highlight of the story. It really was, because they were an oppressed people who were used to getting pushed around, and it probably was nice to read a story about how your evil oppressors were finally getting what's coming to them. Still, though, it's not exactly the happiest part of the story. It's kind of sad. But sadly, though, it was the law of the land. If you were somehow managed to pass a trial by ordeal, it meant whoever accused you was the one guilty, and they should get your punishment. And so that's what happens here. And not only that, but the king probably wants to get rid of these people who are now very obviously bad advisors, who are not looking out for the king's best interests. And so that happens in this case. But in Daniel's case, we see three reasons in the text for why he is saved from the lions, why he's untouched by them. Verse 22 gives two reasons. Verse 23 gives another one. The first two reasons are Daniel was saved because he was innocent in God's eyes. God saw no fault in him. Even though he didn't obey the law of the land, God still said he's good. But then we also see he's saved because the text says, "Before you, O king, I have done no harm." And that's interesting, too. So Daniel wasn't running around talking about how horrible the king was. He was still a good citizen, except for in the case of this one law here that he broke, the law that he was refused to obey. Verse 23 gives further reason, because he had trusted in his God. And that goes back to the tension. There might have been some tension in there, but he was like, God's going to take care of me. It's going to be okay. And now we continue the story. There's not much left of it. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, "Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions." So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. See, Darius, like Nebuchadnezzar a few chapters earlier, makes this royal decree about how the real God is the real God, he's the real deal, and everybody should love him. It's kind of fun reading statements like that from these guys who are kings of these large powers, these guys of great power making those announcements that God is the real power. And so it's because of this story, because of what happens with Daniel in the lion's den, with all these laws, Darius learns there's actually a law higher than the law of the land. And it is the law of the Lord, the law of God. And when the two clash, Darius decides, you know what, there's a higher law than the law of the land. The law of the Medes and the Persians can't be revoked, but I'm going to do it anyway. And he actually passes another law that says, ignore the first one, worship God instead. And it doesn't give any lion's den problems included in there. But have you caught on how this story teaches about how the story about law teaches that despite presence appearances, God is in control? I mean, it's not a crazy hard one to get a moral out of. There's the law of the land, but really it's got no power. The law of the land's only power is force. That's why you've got police officers, because the law itself is not powerful. That's why Babylon needed a lion's den, because they needed some teeth to the law to scare you into doing it. It takes force to rule with those laws. But there's another law at play, too, in this story, and that's the law of the lions, the natural law, the law of natural selection or instinct, however you want to call it. Lions don't need law. They don't. You don't see the lion pride. Yeah, I was going to say herd. The lion pride. You don't see them passing laws and making judgments and being like, oh, well, Simba, you should go after Scar. You don't see that happening. They've got instinct and survival of the fittest. The satraps, these guys, became lions in their own right, kind of. They did. They saw Daniel encroaching on their territory, and so they got instinctual, and they went after him, and they tried to argue they were more fit, and survival of the fittest should be at play. But there's a third law at play, too, in this story. There's not just the law of the land and not just the law of the lion, but there's the law of the Lord. It's kind of handy. They all start with L's. Yeah, but the law of the Lord, God's rule, and God is omnipotent, which means he's all-powerful, and God is omniscient, which means he's all-knowing. And so regardless of the law of the land, which has no rule except for force, it has no power except for just brute force, and regardless of the law of the lions, which is just the force of nature, God's rule, which is supernatural, can always shine through. Now, one thing this story does, sadly, is that it illustrates, just it's another example of that the law of the land is not always going to be compatible with the law of the Lord. It's one thing the story gives us witness to, and we know that's true. We've just seen videos that have been released that show some things that are not really good, and their proponents are saying that it's legal. Our highest courts are saying things that go against natural law, and lower courts are supporting lawsuits against those who see otherwise. It's not new, it's not unique. The law of the land does not always match up with the law of the Lord. That happens. It's common. It's commonplace. Daniel faced that in the lion's den. We've got Christian brothers and sisters throughout this world who, by law, are being persecuted by the laws of their lands in which they are finding themselves. And laws aren't being broken in the persecutions that some of them are receiving. The first generations of Christians went through it as well. Peter once had to say in front of court, Peter, one of the apostles of Jesus, in Acts chapter 4, standing before court because he was preaching about Jesus, said this, "This Jesus is the stone that was rejected by you, the builders, which has become the cornerstone. And there is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved." And then he went on to say a few verses later, "Whether it is right in the sight of God to listen to you rather than to God, you must judge, for we cannot but speak what we have seen and heard." We know that Peter was beaten for saying those things, and then he was released and told, "Don't speak about it again," and he did anyway. And then he's before court just a few verses later, and we see this in Acts chapter 5, "But Peter and the apostles answered, 'We must obey God rather than men.'" Despite whatever law a particular land chooses to invent, whether or not it's actually written into law, or it's just mob law and it's just unwritten rules, they will never surpass the law of God, even if it's got some force behind it at the present time. When the two contradict, you might be forced to choose one or the other. And the example we have with Daniel and with the apostles is, no, don't cave on the law of God for the sake of the law of the land. There are lines you can draw and not cross over them. Now, Daniel wasn't like picking on the king for other reasons, said he was innocent before the king. And we have scriptures in the New Testament that tell us to obey our governments. But when the two laws contradict, we are told which way to go with. Now, thankfully, we live in a pretty nice country. There's not many times the laws contradict. Thankfully, there's not that many opportunities where the two contradict. But there are still some unwritten laws, and there are some times when you are forced to choose occasionally. But I think a big lesson from Daniel is don't wait to be reactive against a stupid law. Daniel's example is that he was living beforehand one way, and when the law became place, he didn't have to change who he was. He didn't have to stress out and be like, oh, do I follow this law or not? He just kept doing what he was doing. It's a lot easier to form a habit when there's not a gun pointed at you, I would think. I've never had to form a habit with that situation, but my thought is that being who you are is a lot easier when you don't have to be stressed about the choice. So let's live out God's law while it's not outlawed. I think that's a good thing to do. And when I say law, I don't mean the Torah, which is sometimes what you're talking about, the Pentateuch. I'm not talking about God's Old Testament laws. I'm talking the law that's written on the hearts of men, the moral law, the things that we know are right from wrong, the things that Scripture teaches us in the New Testament that are right and wrong. Because when push comes to shove, it's going to be a lot easier to fall back on habits and who you are than having to come up with something new on the spot, especially if it's going to cost something. Now, Daniel's position is not that different from the early Christians. I already cited the earliest Christians, Peter and the apostles. But even the next couple hundred years, it got worse after where the New Testament finishes its history. The next couple hundred years, during Roman rule, you were free to worship anybody or anything you wanted. It was pretty much fair game with religion back then. There was no strong laws about it except for one caveat. You had to also worship the Caesar and call him Lord. And then you could go on your way. They actually gave out coins at one point during the Roman history that if you worshipped Caesar, you'd get your coin, and then you could go to whatever church you wanted to or anything, and if they accused you, you'd be like, got my coin, and they're like, okay, you can go worship whatever. And Christians weren't able to get these and because they refused to submit to the law of the land because it contradicted the law of the Lord that says worship only God. He's the only God. And so they were actually called atheists, which is a bit ironic. Some of the first people called atheists in the history of the world were Christians because they didn't worship the people that everyone told them to worship. And so they were called atheists. You're without religion. And they were without state-sanctioned religion, and they were okay with that. But the same was true of Daniel. He refused to pray to the king, even in his case, even though it was just 30 days, and he was persecuted for it. The early Christians were not spared from the law of the land, even though Daniel just got a trial by ordeal. The early Christians did not. And many of them were thrown into the much bigger version of the lion's den, the Colosseum. We've got record of that in history. Because they dared to say that Jesus is the only way to heaven, and even if you try and make me do something else, I'm not going to, because Jesus is the only way to heaven. He said so himself in his teachings. His apostles said it in their teachings. I'm going to trust what Jesus said over what anyone else says. Because Jesus claimed to be unique. The verse I quoted for our communion time, Jesus saying, no one comes to the Father except through him. The verse I read that Peter before the court said, he said, there's no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. You can either consider Jesus and his apostles liars, or you can think other religions are going to get you to heaven. It's those are your two options, is you have to consider them liars to get around that. And you might say, well, that's bad news if you're saying not everyone can go to heaven through these all other doors, but it's actually good news because Jesus wasn't vague. He was very direct. He says, come to me, I'm the way, follow me. That's good news that we should be sharing, because that's the law of the Lord as well, to share that news. All too often, though, we are fearful, I think, and not necessarily fearing acting on our faith. I mean, you're here in this building, so you don't fear some extent of acting on at least some component of some faith somewhere in your head. We show up to church, we sometimes pray, we sometimes read our own Bibles, hopefully. We hopefully give to the church and other causes greater than ourselves, but the thing that I think a lot of us have the barriers up with is talking about our faith with people. That's where we get fearful often. And I'm not going to take time to explain it, but I will just quote this verse that Chris was first service, that Jim read for us at the beginning of this service, 1 Peter 3:13-17. Now, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good than, or if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. So if you ever do fear speaking, it's better to suffer, because if maybe tongue-tied or someone makes fun of you or something happens, there's more blessings for you in that than in being silent. Despite present tension, because of any worldly laws, God's law will always win, is the moral of Daniel chapter 6. The whole book is, despite any circumstances, God's always in control, is the whole book's lesson. Now let me conclude today with a prayer. For this prayer, it's going to be a written prayer. It's Psalm 19, because I think it illustrates well several components of some things I talked about today. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There's no speech, nor are there words, whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving its chamber, and like a strong man runs its course with joy. Its rising is from the end of the heavens, and its circuit to the end of them, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The rules of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, even much fine gold, sweeter also than honey and drippings of the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is your servant warned. In keeping them there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Declare me innocent from hidden faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless and innocent of great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Amen.